This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Ali Mahabir, your host for this episode. We are grateful to be joined by Erin L. Durban, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, affiliated with American Studies, Gender, Women, Sexuality Studies, and the Center for Race, Indigeneity, Disability, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. Their scholarship works at the intersections of interdisciplinary feminist and queer studies, transnational American studies, critical disability studies, and critical ecologies. A very, very warm welcome to the podcast, Erin. Very happy to be talking to you about your book, The Sexual Politics of Empire, Post-Colonial Homophobia in Haiti.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you could be here. So could you tell me a little bit more about yourself? I guess going a bit beyond what I just said in the intro, your personal story, how you came to be who you are today, and what experiences prompted you to write the book we're talking about?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's not immediately apparent is that I write about this a little bit in the very first part of the book, that I have these family connections to Haiti. And I wouldn't say they're thick connections. I didn't grow up there. My parents didn't grow up there. But they were enough for me to really feel like I had an obligation and a responsibility to learn more about Haiti and the United States' relationship with Haiti. And so I opened the book thinking through those different kinds of connections. And I want to say, even though I have those very particular connections, for instance, one of them is my dad and my uncle lived in Haiti. They had a little business. And when I was born, I was taken home from the hospital in a basket that came from Haiti that they had brought from there. That even though I have these connections to Haiti that are longer in my family, part of what I'm really trying to do in my work, both in the book, but then in my scholarship in general, is have people who are from the United States, particularly white people, think about these long-term relationships to Haiti. And so it's not necessarily, even though I situate the work and this book that we're going to talk about today in those personal experiences, I really want people to consider the relationship even without those like very personal connections. And the United States has these colonial, neo-colonial, imperialist relationships all around the world. And so this is one opening into thinking about those. I suppose there are many different ways to answer the question about who I am. I could tell you, my work now, I've been doing a lot more in critical disability studies than when I was working on this book. My work in Haiti really brought me to thinking about disability and critical disability studies. When the earthquake happened, a lot more people, it was a disabling event, and a lot more people were thinking about disability, but it was always present in my fieldwork, where, and specifically disabled activists were in Haiti, were trying to draw connections to to the work that queer activists were doing in Haiti. And so that brought me into thinking about disability in a more academic kind of way. And a lot of the work that I do now, as I was finishing the book, and then my current scholarship is more centrally located in critical disability studies, but thinking through, critical disability studies is where feminist studies, queer studies, critical ethnic studies meets considerations of ability and disability. And I think those are maybe two different ways into thinking about who I am as a scholar and what I do and my commitments.
So you mentioned the work of queer activists. One of the interesting things you discuss in the book, just to veer off a bit, is that you don't seem to use the word queer in a lot of instances when describing persons in Haiti. Instead, you use the term same-sex desiring and gender creative for LGBTQI plus individuals. Can you explain? I thought that was interesting. I'm wondering if you could explain the reasoning behind this choice, why it was an important choice to use in the context of the book, because it's almost like you maybe problematize the use of queer almost.
Yes. Yes, that's a great question. So the people who I engaged with, the Haitians I engaged with over, you know, a very long time of making this book, identify so many different ways with Creole words, with English words, with French words. And there's no way, part of what I do as a scholar is sort of track how people use those terms, what they mean to different people. And I am a product of queer studies in the academy. My PhD is in feminist studies, and I really am situated in transnational feminist studies and transnational queer studies. And so I have a history of using queer as a term sort of coming out of US activism, out of the US Academy. But when I was working on a special issue same-sex desiring and gender creative Haitians and their artwork and resistance with my colleagues, Mario Lamothe and Dasha Chapman, we kept bumping up against the word queer and what it meant for each of us in the U.S. Academy and doing the different kinds of scholarly work and solidarity work we do in Haiti. And we each recognized that though there are Haitians who identify as queer in Haiti, though that is very uncommon, and then in the diaspora, that it didn't really fit the work that we were doing. Queer is an Anglo word. And it's really difficult to pronounce in Creole, where a lot of other terms lend themselves to creolization easily and pronunciation. Also, a lot of activists specifically did not like the term queer. And I get into that in the book a bit, is that even though a lot of these terms circulate transnationally, have European roots that people identify with, like homosexual or gay or lesbian, that queer in particular signaled a kind of foreign politics that people didn't want to be associated with. So now when people in Haiti use the terms of how we would say like LGBTQIA+, it is just LGBT and I without the Q. And so we collectively were thinking about how to call the field that we were working in. And when we kept having these different kinds of troubles with queer, we decided that we needed different ways to talk about what people were, you know, what same-sex desiring and gender creative activists were doing without using the umbrella term queer. So even though I opened our interview up using that term as a recognizable term that circulates internationally, I moved away from that in the book with this very cumbersome, I mean, it's difficult to write or say over and over again, same-sex desiring and gender creative. And actually, that's a difficult thing to translate into Creole as well. But it is a way of describing a range of different subjectivities that I'm interested in, that the project follows, and the relationships that were made without necessarily being attached to one particular identity term. And so really what I'm doing in the book is situating all of those identity terms, like why is it that people at different times move towards using Creole terms or Creole words. What does that mean to them? And so queer gets situated in a very particular way. At the same time, I'm still in queer studies and want to articulate with the concerns of that field in my work in the academy, but then also I would say have a sense of integrity with the ways that people show up in the world and how they describe themselves throughout the book.
Yeah, I also remember in the book you incorporate or use like local Creole terms like, maybe I'm butchering this, but Masisi, Madivin, to describe same-sex desiring and gender creative Haitians. So are these terms that people themselves use in Haiti? And could you explain also the history of them? And also what I found interesting is that it sort of exists in tension with terms imported from sort of global North context.
Yeah, so things really shifted over the time I was doing field work. I first went to Haiti in 2008, and then the last time I was in Haiti was 2016. And even though I haven't been back, I sort of maintain relationships with people there and in the diaspora. And so, I mean, that's an unusually long amount of time to do field work someplace. Most people go places for a year or 2 years. So that doesn't necessarily allow you to see change over time. And I noticed how people use different kinds of identity terms or ways of describing themselves in different contexts over that time and how it changed. So when I first went, for example, and I sort of was immersed in networks, mostly of artists, a lot of the men that I met would use gay as a way to describe themselves. Because within Haiti, a lot of people didn't know what gay meant. It wasn't part of, it wasn't recognizable. And so it was a way of sort of being able to talk about same-sex sexuality and openly without having other people recognize what it was. So it was sort of like an insider term that people could use instead of like, I mean, most of the recognizable words are French words that, I mean, probably most noticeable is like homosexual. And then there were all the derogatory words that people would come up against. And masisi is one of those words. It's a really negative, strongly charged word to talk about both male same-sex sexuality and male effeminacy. And so I noticed people really avoided using those terms. Gay felt neutral compared to these like either sort of like right. European sort of fancy words or the derogatory terms. But as people I was around went through different experiences, they radicalized, their politics radicalized. And it was a really interesting thing to see that some of those same artists who had used gay embraced the negative terminology of masisi to create a politics where they said, here is this word that's been used against us in these really awful ways. And what we're going to do is embrace that and like take the negative charge of that word and really throw it back in people's faces. And so having the experiences people went through of confronting different forms of homophobic and transphobic violence had them then embracing Creole terms that were negative instead of gay, or like situationally, like using gay to sort of talk to foreigners, but then using masisi to claim a particular kind of really abject subject position to mobilize politically from. And that was a really powerful turning point. That's before many years later, there was a manifesto put out by an activist group called Courage that did similar kinds of work, but it was really saying like they put out a statement that said, we're inheritors of the Haitian Revolution, that there are these different categories of people, including Masisi, also Madivinez, which is another negatively charged word mostly used against same-sex desiring women. They reclaimed those terms as a whole to make an assertion of like using those Creole indigenous sort of subject formations to create a broad political platform of what they called the M community. So there are many other different terms in Creole other than Masisi and Madivinez, but that's where they articulated their politics from rather than using the term LGBT community. And so it was a response that was similar to what had happened in these not political groups that I had been part of that sort of became radicalized and politicized. And so, it really transformed the meaning of those words, not just to say this is a Haitian version of gay, that they're equivalent, but taking the histories of those terms, mostly for people that they were negative, and like using them as powerful ways to talk about the undervaluing of same-sex desiring and gender creative people in Haiti, and ask people to align and be in solidarity with those groups. So those are some of the ways that those terms changed in different situational contexts. But I mean, you don't have to travel very far in Haiti or in the diaspora to hear negative terms. And even as I, you know, when I present about my research, it's still really hard for people to hear those terms. There's a lot of controversy about these sorts of reclamation projects. And for U.S. audiences, like there's similar kinds of feelings about the word queer as a negative term a lot of people grew up with that now travels in lots of different ways. I would pay attention. I mean, those are sort of big turning events, but like, what are the ways people described their desires, their relationships when they live in the countryside and don't have a lot of contact with organizations? I started my work not before the time of social media. We were already into Facebook, but it just wasn't as common. Not everybody had cell phones. But by the time I, you know, concluded my field work, that had completely changed. I mean, everybody was on social media, cell phone, like everybody had a cell phone. So there's then new kinds of access to international media forms that really changed, again, how people connect with others around their desires and gender presentations. So there's a lot in there about language. Yeah.
And there's a lot we could dig into with that. I mean, I found it really interesting how those terms, they sort of been reclaimed. And in a way, at least for some people, a sort of destigmatization process has taken place. And you alluded to it with the use of the word queer, in that among some populations, the same sort of process has taken place. So it's interesting to see some similarities there. But at the same time, for some populations, it's definitely something that still offends, that still stings, that can still have major, impacts on individuals. And they would take it in different ways depending on who they are and where they come from. So it's interesting with, you know, social media, how that might change the landscape going forward. And maybe there's opportunities for future research there. Who knows? But other things I want to get into, and maybe we could switch gears a bit, is that, you mentioned, you know, talking about a lot of activists, organizations, and just in general, same-sex desiring and gender creative Haitians. I'm hoping maybe you could, before we go forward, specify or talk on the sort of methodology you would have used as you engage with these individuals. I think in the book you mentioned employing what's called a patchwork ethnography. You mentioned you were there for many years. So
Could you get into the sort of methods you would have abused in doing the research to write this book?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm really truly an interdisciplinary scholar. I'm housed in anthropology now, and the anthropologist really recognized that I had done ethnographic field work, which involves spending time with people, being immersed, participant observation, where you're really in the social scene, not separate from it, that you're thinking about your position and who you are in relationship to other people. And in a almost troubling way, part of what was recognizable is that I'm, from the US and I'm a white person who went to a foreign country for this field work. And that's like an old model of anthropology, where you would go to the first sort of ethnographic research was in the Pacific Islands, and stay there and then report about a culture. Anthropology doesn't do that anymore, but they saw that my methods resonated with what people do in international context, also in US context. I really, one of the things I notice is like I engage a lot of historical texts. I'm not a historian, but I spend a lot of time in archives thinking about really, I would go. I put the history in conversation with my research. Like I wanted to know, why were there so many US missionaries in Haiti? Why was Haiti going through this change while I was there of being having been a Catholic country for so long and becoming increasingly more Protestant? Where did these ideas about Black sexuality come from and Haitian sexuality specifically? Because these were the things that were shaping the lives and struggles of the people I was spending time with, whether they were same-sex desiring and gender creative Haitians who were just like living their lives, working in a restaurant, or whether they were activists and like actively working against different ideas about what same-sex sexuality and gender creativity, transgender means in a Haitian context. So I tried to like follow those things backwards to really be in service of the movements that were working to change things in Haiti. And I would say, part of my field work was paying attention to those kinds of threads, paying attention to what people were saying. And sometimes this was difficult. Like I, one of the changes that I document in the book is that when the earthquake happened, these US human rights organizations really ramped up their involvement in Haiti. Some of them had been there before, some of them hadn't. And they were particularly then concerned about LGBTQI rights. And I noticed that people started using the terms of these international organizations. Like I started hearing LGBT, LGBT, LGBT. And I had already been paying attention to language. And it was so shocking the first time I heard that, that I knew, like, I knew something was different. But when I brought it up to the people I was organizing with, they're like, oh no, we've always been this, right? Like, it made sense that here is a new sort of term that has been introduced, and that, but people feel the resonance in it. And so they'd say, oh no, we've always been this. And, it was really difficult, actually. I didn't talk about this in the book, but like to document an absence before a presence, because people kept saying, oh no, that's not true. We had used this before this time. And so that took a tremendous amount of work, and it doesn't even appear, but I noticed that it coincided with those international organizations becoming more involved there. And I wanted to, so then sort of learn more about those organizations, why they had gotten involved. I had sort of intimate experiences with one, because one of the groups I was involved with, who had hosted me, it was an artist organization that had hosted me as a researcher in residence. They were very generous, and they usually have an artist residency program of like sort of creating a space for me as a scholar. I had helped write grants on behalf of the organization after the earthquake, and could see these processes happening, could see that I was part of them, and sort of watch the effects of it, even though I didn't know in advance what those might be. And so all of these things are not exactly typical ethnographic research methods. I mean, there are other pieces of it, but it felt really like I drew on my training in literary studies and cultural studies, and to help think through the changes that I was seeing to be in service of these movements. And when I read other work coming out in queer studies, I can recognize people's sort of interdisciplinary methods that also include ethnography. There's something about my generation of scholarship where we feel untethered from the disciplinary mandates of how to do research, and can be really creative and follow different threads. And I really appreciate having that, because I see sometimes, you know, if you like, if this project were just historical, it would have looked really different. A lot of the historical parts of this are informed by what's happening on the ground.
Amazing. I think despite it being, you know, different threads or coming from different disciplines or different methodological discourses, I think it all came together well to tell a really, you know, compelling and cohesive story. And one of the things you would have mentioned that I kind of want to get into is that the sort of embracing of sort of global north terms with the sort of rise of the influence of what you term global LGBTQI human rights organizations. Is it something that was embraced by most creative Haitians? Was it something that was more maybe of people belonging to a particular class or, you know, sort of in professional circles? Could you get into that a bit?
Yeah, that's also a really great question. From the time I started, these Global North terms were in circulation. So I said, I mentioned gay as an example, or homosexual, but it was really like thinking about like the shift to LGBT told me something new was happening and these organizations came in, but like they layered on top of, especially I think people got information before that off the internet. But then also if they were involved in organizations, a lot of times they were involved in organizations that did sexual health education. So it was part of the sort of setup in the country to address HIV/AIDS. And so it's not like there were no organizations before the earthquake, but the focus was really different. They were health organizations, public health organizations. And then the ones that came in were specifically focused on human rights. Those global LGBTQ, now it's interesting because also these international human rights organizations have also dropped the Q. So like it's like marks a particular moment, the Q in my research. I have many reasons I could speculate about that, but they are mostly speculation, but they worked specifically with a handful of organizations, and that's really where people were using LGBT, and it was situational. Like people mostly did not use it to talk internally amongst, like with other Haitians. People still stuck with like particular identity terms. It didn't really like spread through Haiti, the LGBT. It was like in these little pockets of people who had sort of non-governmental organization expertise where they could articulate to international audiences. And it was like very strategic, and it was a way of sort of articulating with other groups and organizations. So like when I needed to get back into the country after the earthquake, I went through the Dominican Republic, and there was a lesbian feminist organization in Santo Domingo that was doing solidarity work with Haitian queer and feminist organizations, is how they talked about it. But the Haitian activists who came and met us in Santo Domingo and were doing this work really wanted to be able to talk to like across different spaces, and like Haitian terminology doesn't always do that. Like there's a lot of explanation, like some of the little bits that I've included in this interview about like the meaning of those terms. So it's a way to connect in South-South relationships and not always just to articulate, though often also to articulate to like US, Canadian, European audiences.
And, other than language, in what other ways did LGBTQI human rights organizations, how did they sort of factor in what you call a sexual politics of rescue after the earthquake? And what other ways were they affecting the circumstances of same-sex desiring and gender-creative Haitians? And also, did they affect the local organizations also attempting to cater to their needs?
Yeah, I mean, they really, I say they ramped up their work in Haiti. There was like a huge need after the earthquake. I mean, the earthquake in 2010, because right. there have been more recent earthquakes, was really devastating. And people needed access to, you know, very basic things, water, food, hygiene supplies. And so, you know, internationally, that was provided by lots of people, right? The not just the U.S. and Canadian, our government and military and organizations, but also like the Cuban Red Cross came and Cuban doctors came. So it was part of an effort that was organized for to meet these really intense needs people had immediately after the earthquake. And the international organizations, what I call the global LGBTQI human rights organizations, they focused on a particular problem, which is that there was discrimination against same-sex desiring and gender creative people for being able to access a lot of the resources for relief and recovery. But so they came in, and then also we organized through networks to provide like a lot of the basic things that people were needing that I mentioned, tents to just sort of be able to get out of the elements when so much of the housing was, if it had not collapsed, it was unusable. Also, people were really afraid because there were a lot of aftershocks. And also things that other organizations didn't address, like condoms, which like other like not LGBTQI organizations may not think of as a basic need. And so they did this work, and there was one of the organizations, Igel Herc. I'm trying to remember. They switched their name recently, so I'm trying to remember their new name. They did more research to be able to produce essentially like a country report about these problems. When they did this, I got the report, and I was deeply concerned because I noticed that I had a really different analysis than them, and that they had come and done sort of short-term relief work that was necessary at the time, but then produce knowledge from that space that I found really problematic. And at that time, I was really struggling after the earthquake. I didn't actually know if I would continue the project. A lot of people I knew had died, and it just like being there after such a big disaster, it was really disheartening. And there was a lot of grief where it felt like it immobilized the project. And when I read their report, I realized that I knew things that they didn't know and things that were really important to understanding Haiti's history. And the first one of those things was that, it was about the Catholic culture in Haiti being homophobic. And I was like, wait a second. that's not exactly right. Actually, weirdly, Catholicism is more progressive than a lot of the Protestant sects that are in Haiti. And I saw that there were more virulent forms of homophobia, religious homophobia, that were there. And like, to sort of figure out like where those different forms of homophobia were coming from, I was like, Catholicism is really rooted in European colonialism in Haiti. First Spanish and then French. And then, there's this longer history of sort of, sexual politics related to Catholicism that I looked into more in the country. But I knew that the shift by then was really to Protestantism's being like more present in the country was related to U.S. intervention, like 100 years of U.S. intervention in Haiti. And so in this report that this organization produced that got a lot of attention, they essentially, without knowing, erased this history of U.S. militarization and occupation of Haiti, the subsequent missionaries that had come to fight voodoo, which is like a whole... there's a long history of really racist representations of voodoo coming out of Haiti from U.S. and European audiences, and so I like tracked all those things and to show that this report had not gotten that analysis right. But the other thing that was really concerning to me in the work of that organization and many of the others is that they were not interested in Haitian solutions to the different things that were happening in Haiti. They really advocated for more foreign intervention, for more U.S. intervention in particular, and that in that way, it felt really, the structure of what they were doing felt really similar to what U.S. missionaries and European missionaries had done for a century. And where they thought, right, the U.S. and Europe had the right solutions for Haiti, that they would come and offer and proselytize and run things. And so even though on one side you have these different forms of Christianity that are more and less homophobic, and then you have these international organizations, human rights organizations that come in to address those forms of homophobia that seem really, you know, they are essentially pro-LGBT, and those they seem opposed, that in their promotion of U.S. exceptionalism, they are really very similar. And so that's how I like structure thinking about the sexual politics of empire, that there are these two social movements that seem to be opposed, that circulate transnationally, but then they have similar effects in Haiti and other racialized post-colonial spaces where that seems to be contrary to what we know about LGBTQI activism. But I really wanted to highlight how all of that refracts through empire and the continual sort of support of ongoing militarization, which is, again, at another moment of time here we are thinking about the different ways that the U.S. is propping up Haitian leadership and then the different kinds of foreign intervention, again, that are being talked about in another historical moment.
That's one of the most, interesting things you talk about in the book, the sort of same, problems of colonial tendencies or what I would call metropolitan thinking or colonial thinking being exhibited, not just by the Christian missionaries of the past, but there's a reflection of that in the present day sort of actions and behaviors of these global LGBTQI organizations. And though well-intentioned, they're still sort of, suggest these foreign interventions and not necessarily bad in some ways, but informed by a thinking that is not based in, local nuances, local needs, and local context. To me, that was one of the most, striking writing in the book. So, Erin, I really enjoy talking to you, but unfortunately, we're sort of up on time, so we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon. There's so many other things I found interesting in the book, and I wanted to talk to you about going more into the history of the missionaries there, the concept of Zonbi in the book and these performances, Frankie Tien's novel De Fazi, how they sort of have links and influence in Haiti's Christian homophobia, and also offer sort of acts of resistance, the Pierre-Louis controversy. But I guess we're going to have to leave it to listeners to get the book and find out all that other interesting stuff for themselves. So I at this point, I'll ask to wrap things up. You mentioned, you sort of keep contacts with the persons you have engaged with doing your research. It draws a lot on their lived experiences of these people, these same-sex and gender creative Haitians. I want to know, Haiti has been going through some tumultuous times lately. A lot of economic and political turmoil precipitated by the assassination of President Moïse. My understanding is that gangs have gained control in Port-au-Prince. I think right now Prime Minister Henri has not returned. I want to know, keeping up with the contacts, how are they doing? Do you have any insights or knowledge as to how also the current situation is affecting the lives of same-sex cesarean and gender creative Haitians?
Yeah, and I mean, one of the assertions of the book is that the conditions generally in Haiti are really, like, you can't really think about, something like LGBTQI rights without thinking about these broader conditions, whether that's sort of the post-earthquake conditions, whether it's colonialism, whether it's militarization. Most of the time of my field work, there was the quote-unquote peacekeeping mission that included lots of armed soldiers and tanks in the streets. And so with the structural conditions right now, it impacts everybody. I work with, in the Haitian Studies Association, there's a sexuality studies working group that the colleagues who I mentioned before, and then some more in the U.S. Academy who are Haitian and also artists and activists in Haiti are part of. And so a lot of our work now is sort of highlighting the needs of Haitians in general, what the situations call for, but then also providing material support to people who aren't able to access what they need in Haiti, because mobility is really constrained, and also the prices of things go up, and like basic things like rice become really difficult to access. And so we do a lot of sort of, I would say, you know, mutual aid. So even while we're working on our sort of scholarly projects, we maintain those relationships on the ground. That's really important. And I strongly believe that like my job as a foreigner and somebody who benefits from U.S. empire in Haiti is to amplify progressive Haitian voices and to follow the lead of Haitians who are putting forward different kinds of solutions. And that's, I mean, that's not easy to do because people have a lot of disagreements about what should happen next. We're muddling along, trying to do the best we can sort of alongside another really difficult situation.
I think that's a powerful note to end on. Despite the struggle and the circumstances, we still have to muddle on and find a way. You mentioned what's next. At this point, I'll ask, you know, what's next for you? Are you hoping to build on the ideas you explored in the book in any way? Any material you have out or you're currently working on you'd like to share at this time? Is there any way for people to help with the sort of work you're doing in meeting the material needs of persons in Haiti? Anything at all you'd like to bring attention to?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, I have a list of Haitian organizations that are doing really good work in Haiti. I don't know if it's possible to share that with the podcast instead of like going through all of them. I feel like right now my role is doing the work that I just mentioned, but then also supporting junior Haitian scholars who are in sort of feminist and queer studies. For different reasons, I think it's going to be really hard for me to keep working in Haiti. After my field work concluded, I got really sick. And then I was diagnosed with multiple autoimmune syndrome. And it just, even if the conditions were not as bad as they are in Haiti, it would be really hard for me to do. And so, I feel like there are really great scholars whose books are going to be coming out that speak to the same issues but come at it from a different perspective. My work is to sort of promote the good scholarship that's coming out and to do this work in Haiti. Otherwise, my projects are different. Thinking about like what does it mean to do research as a disabled scholar in a different way than my than what I was doing before.
Well, definitely share with me the names of those organizations. There's an accompanying blog post that goes along with the audio for the Great. Podcast, so we could definitely have that up for people to see. All right. So before we say goodbye, can you let everyone know where they can find your book and where they can also reach you if they want to have any sort of follow-up discussions or, you know, have anything they want to add to what we said today?
Thank you. Yeah, my book is available through the University of Illinois Press, and I'll say I got a grant to make it open access. So pretty soon on the University of Illinois Press website, people will be able to access it for free as an ebook. You can also buy it if you want a hard copy. I am an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and I have a site through the university that lists my email address, and I would be very happy to talk to people if they reach out by email.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I guess that's a wrap. Thanks so much for having this conversation with me, Erin. I think it went really well. I wish you all the best and have a good one today.
Thank you. You too. I appreciate the invitation and the follow-up.